Hey there, it's Joshua. Thanks for checking out the 1A podcast. Before we start the roundup, we would love to know your input on how we're doing, what you like, what you don't like, what we could be doing better. Please do let us know via text message. Text the word podcast to 63735 to join the 1A text club and to send us your feedback. We'll send you updates from time to time. You can always stop those updates by texting the word stop. And again, to send us your feedback on the podcast, join the 1A text club, text the word podcast to 63735. All right, on to the roundup. Thanks. This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting WESA Public Radio in Pittsburgh. The biggest news this week was all about what might happen next week. Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh may testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee again in the coming days, this time to address an accusation of sexual assault that is alleged to have occurred while Kavanaugh was in high school. The judge's accuser revealed her identity and may also testify after requesting an FBI probe into the incident. We'll look ahead to what might happen next week and what all this would mean for Kavanaugh's confirmation process. We'll also get the latest on what's happening in cities along the southeastern coast after Florence left major damage and killed dozens of people. Plus, since we are in Pittsburgh, we'll get a read on how Catholics around the state of Pennsylvania are doing after the bombshell grand jury report about a high-level sex abuse cover-up in the Catholic Church. Joining us here at WESA is the station's government editor, Chris Potter. Chris, welcome to the roundup.
Good to be here and welcome to Pittsburgh.
Also with us is Selena Zito, reporter for The Washington Examiner, columnist for The New York Post, and co-author of The Great Revolt. We've had you on the program many times remotely. It's great to finally meet you. Selena, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
And back at our home base in Washington is Cheryl Gay Stolberg, Washington correspondent for The New York Times. Hi, Cheryl.
Hey, Joshua. It's a little lonely here in Washington today.
I know we'll be back before you know it, I promise. And I promise we will get to as many of your questions and thoughts about this week's top stories as we can. So email us, 1A@WAMU.org. Comment on our Facebook page where you can watch our video stream or tweet us at 1A. Well, we've got to start with Judge Kavanaugh. It's been quite a week for the Supreme Court nominee. This week, Christine Blasey Ford, a psychologist and professor based in Northern California, identified herself in the Washington Post as the woman who had accused Kavanaugh of sexual assault in high school. Cheryl, this story's moved pretty fast, so why don't I just start with you? Tell us where things stand right now.
So where things stand now is that lawyers for Dr. Blasey, as she prefers to be known, are negotiating with Democratic and Republican aides on the Senate Judiciary Committee to arrange for her testimony sometime next week. Senate Republicans had demanded that she testify on Monday. Dr. Blasey says that's simply too soon. Monday is out for her. Her lawyers are proposing Thursday. There are a few sticking points. The lawyers wanted the Republicans on the committee to subpoena Mark Judge, a friend of Kavanaugh, who Blasey says was in the room at the time of the assault. The Republicans on the committee say no, that's a non-starter for them. Blasey also wanted Judge Kavanaugh to testify first. That's a non-starter for Republicans. And finally, the Republicans, in an effort to avoid kind of the impolitic appearance of having 11 male members of the Judiciary Committee, all Republican men, questioning Dr. Blasey, wanted to have an outside counsel. And they were looking to hire a woman to do the questioning of both Judge Kavanaugh and Dr. Blasey. Dr. Blasey doesn't want that. Her lawyers feel that it would create sort of an appearance of a prosecution. It would give the hearing a prosecutorial tone. And they want the senators to do the questioning. So I suspect all these details will be kind of ironed out in further negotiations today. We may hear sometime later today that there's a settlement or an agreement for a way forward. But bottom line, I bet there's testimony and a public hearing next week.
Selena Zito, what is your sense of the comparison that's been made several times in the last few days between this confirmation process and Clarence Thomas's confirmation process with Anita Hill? She testified before the Senate regarding sexual harassment allegations against the then nominee. Do you see them as mostly similar, mostly different, kind of a split?
Well, I mean, you have to think back to the time that it happened with Clarence Thomas. I can remember, vividly because Arlen Specter at the time was our U.S. senator.
Senator from Pennsylvania.
And some of his questions were considered, even in the time, as sort of a sexist and or tone deaf or without sensitivity to what she may have gone through. But we're in a completely different moment right now. I think that even though all the members of the Judiciary Committee on the Republican side are male, I think they are well aware of that they are in a different moment and that questions don't become what Specter and that team did in what was it? I forget what year it was.
1991.
Yeah.
Now, Dr. Blasey Ford initially sent a letter about the allegations to Senator Dianne Feinstein of California. She is the ranking Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee. And Chris Porter, a lot of the narrative this week around what's been going on has had to do with that letter, particularly the fact that the letter was not released immediately and it took a while for it and the story to come to light.
Yeah, and Republicans have certainly tried to use this against the Democrats in particular and say, if this was a earnest inquiry, if you seriously had these concerns, why didn't you bring them up earlier? And the response to that has been, Dr. Ford did not want us to. This is not somebody who's out there looking for this kind of attention. This is somebody who brought it up to her local congressperson first, and then it got forwarded to Dianne Feinstein. So you have this moment, and I think Selena's right. There's a lot of trepidation on the Republican side. Pat Toomey, who's our current Republican senator here in Pennsylvania, not a member of the Judiciary Committee, but obviously being asked about this by reporters earlier this week, and basically declined to really speak to it in the afternoon. And then later that evening, the Senate Judiciary Committee said, we'll have a hearing. Then a couple hours after that, Senator Toomey said, hey, let's have a hearing. That's what we should do. And I think that sort of speaks to the incredible amount of trepidation around this particular issue in both camps. I mean, the Hill hearings, this has surfaced as well. The chair of the Judiciary Committee at that time was a gentleman named Joe Biden. And he now, on the Democratic side, talked about as a 2020 contender, but facing some difficult questions of his own about how far he let things go. And I think that really does speak to this changing environment.
We should also bring President Trump into this because he's been commenting on this quite a bit in the last 12 to 18 hours. Here is part of what he said in an interview with Fox News host Sean Hannity while the president was at a rally in Nevada.
But what do you make of where the Kavanaugh hearings are now? There's a new set of demands that have come out.
I think it's a very sad situation. He's an outstanding person. And frankly, Sean, to see what's going on is just very, very sad. You say, why didn't somebody call the FBI 36 years ago? I mean, you could also say, when did this all happen? What's going on? To take a man like this and besmirch. Now, with that being said, let her have her say, and let's see how it all works out. But I don't think you can delay it any longer. They've delayed it a week already.
And you've been very you've been very accommodating.
I have been accommodating. I say, let her say what she has to say, and let's see how it all comes out. But they've delayed it a week, and they have to get on with it.
Part of the president's conversation with Fox News host Sean Hannity around the time of a rally yesterday in Nevada. Now, earlier this week, one of Dr. Ford's lawyers, Lisa Banks, spoke on CNN with Anderson Cooper.
What we're saying is that there should be an investigation because that's the right thing to do.
If there's not an investigation, would she appear on Monday?
She is prepared to cooperate with the committee and with any law enforcement investigation. And that has been her position and it continues to be her position. So she will cooperate with the committee in whatever form that takes, and it remains to be seen. We have to talk with Senator Grassley's office and the other committee members to determine what form that will take.
That's Attorney Lisa Banks speaking to CNN's Anderson Cooper. Should be noted that the president is also tweeting about this morning. He wrote, quote, Judge Brett Kavanaugh is a fine man with an impeccable reputation who is under assault by radical left-wing politicians who don't want to know the answers. They just want to destroy and delay. Facts don't matter. I go through this with them every single day in D.C. He goes on to write, quote, I have no doubt that if the attack on Dr. Ford was as bad as she says, charges would have been immediately filed with local law enforcement authorities by either her or her loving parents. I ask that she bring those filings forward so that we can learn date, time, and place. And he also wrote, quote, The radical left lawyers want the FBI to get involved now. Why didn't somebody call the FBI 36 years ago? Unquote. Cheryl Gay Stolberg, what impact do we expect the president's comments to have on this?
Well, so I see we're seeing kind of a little bit of a ratcheting up here with the president. President Trump, after all, we should note, has himself been accused of sexual assault. And when those accusations have come directed personally at him, he's responded very vigorously in attacking the women who made those allegations. He's been quite a lot more muted with respect to Dr. Blasey. He hasn't really gone after her this week. This is sort of the first time that we're seeing a little bit of a hint of him sort of addressing his comments to her directly, personally, saying, why didn't you bring this up 36 years ago? Let's see the evidence. I'm sure you must have reported this to local law enforcement. To be fair, it's well known that women who are victims of sexual assault rarely report it and rarely discuss it. So as to what impact the president's comments will have, I think it's maybe a little too soon to tell, but his aides know that he's got to be careful around this.
Lloyd tweeted, "This is a good time to remind people that there are no GOP women on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and there have apparently never been any GOP women on that committee in 27 years since the Anita Hill hearings. How do they expect not to be hurt by these gender optics?" Chris Potter, that's a good point. The women on the committee are all Democratic women, including Dianne Feinstein, right, the ranking member, Mazie Hirono of Hawaii, Amy Klobuchar, Kamala Harris. I mean, it seems like the entire, you know, contingent that has been asking many of these questions from the perspective of women in positions of authority is all on the Democratic side. But how do you see this playing out going forward? Well, it seems like the GOP is at least willing, if Dr. Ford wanted, to have a female attorney do the questioning on their behalf.
Yeah, and if I were a Republican senator, I would want a female attorney questioning on my behalf. I mean, that's courtroom strategy 101, right? You got a lawyer up there who sort of presents your case in a way that's going to allay just those kinds of concerns. You know, this is an issue, and it's deepening politically. If we look at this 2018 season of primaries, Democrats more and more often are choosing women as their nominees, and it's the opposite trend on the Republican side. So that kind of optical situation is tough, and there's a broader issue too, which is if we look beyond what this hearing is going to be next week, some of the arguments made on Judge Kavanaugh's behalf. I mean, he has always denied, stridently denied, that this incident ever happened. But there's also been this strain of defense for him, which is, even if it did happen, it's really not so bad. It shouldn't, what he did at 17 shouldn't affect him now. And I think that is, as the kids say, also a bad look, right? I mean, for those of us like myself raising a kid, maybe we're not so crazy about a political environment that sort of is sending that kind of message about what teenage behavior means and whether it's important or not. So he's not even on the bench. He's not even on the Supreme Court bench, and yet this has become a test case in some ways for this country and for where it's at.
Selena Zito, I wonder what we see going forward from here, regardless of whether or not, and I hear you, Chris, on whether this is a bad look, but regardless of that, I wonder what it seems like right now, just as a snapshot of today, in terms of whether it leans toward her testifying or not, whether it leans toward an FBI investigation or not. I feel like the FBI investigation part is a lot easier. That's probably not going to happen unless the president orders it, and he's not going to order it. But what about the rest of it?
Well, it's in the negotiation process right now, right? Although I want to step back for one second and say the Republicans actually in their primary process this year for Senate races have more women running than they ever have in history. So you have in Mississippi, you have Cindy Highsmith, you have McSally in Arizona, in Wisconsin, and so forth.
Indeed, in Arizona, they are going to have a female senator.
No matter what.
Because Kirsten Sinema is running as a Democrat and Martha McSally running as a Republican.
Yeah, which I thought is kind of interesting. It seems like Republican conservative voters are sort of getting the message, and also they're recruiting good female candidates. And something they have been way behind the times in terms of what the Democrats have been doing for 20 years, since 92, since the year of the woman. But anyways, you know, I mean, I think this thing is still a negotiation process. I don't know if Grassley doesn't say, hey, Monday's it. We gave you more than enough time to meet, you know, we gave you at least a week to be prepared for this. And in some of the demands that I've heard heard from Ford's lawyer is that that Kavanaugh goes first. And that's just, in fairness, that's sort of not how you do it. The accuser should go first because the accused needs to answer to those questions. So I expect today to be a volley of sorts of what will happen on Monday. But I think everyone is sort of holding out hope that it happens on Monday.
And I think ultimately, Cheryl, I mean, there's still the question of what impact this will have going forward. I mean, regardless of what happens in the Senate Judiciary Committee, even if the whole committee said, don't approve this guy, the full Senate could still do it. So there's still another step going forward. And then you
That's
had,
unlikely.
It's unlikely, for sure, but just hypothetically. I mean, there's still more to go forward. And then you have Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island. He gave an interview on CNN where he said, as soon as Democrats get the gavel, we're going to reopen this thing and we're going to try to suss out what actually happened. But at the end, I wonder if all of this, in a larger sense, becomes a plot point in the kind of inevitable confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh.
Well, I don't know that it's necessarily the inevitable confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh. A couple of things I'd say. First of all, I think if Grassley says it's Monday or nothing, that's trouble for the Republicans. This woman is freaked out. She's getting death threats. She's had to move out of her home. She's worried about her children. Both Democrats and Republicans agree that her safety needs to be protected. So for them to come out and say Monday or bust, I think will look like bullying, and they can't afford to look like they're bullying her. Second point, if she testifies, and it seems like she is going to, and she looks credible, then we might end up with a kind of he said, she said that is unfolding in a very different environment than the Hill hearings, as Selena noted. We're in an environment where women are now given the presumption of credibility. Many people are saying, I believe her. And I think that the longer this goes on, the more difficult it becomes for Brett Kavanaugh. You've got two Republican senators, women, Senators Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, who are still on the fence about Kavanaugh. Their votes will be critical. It's a narrowly divided Senate, 51 Republicans and 49 Democrats and, well, 47 Democrats and two independents who caucus with Democrats. So we're kind of dancing on the edge of a razor here. I don't think we know what's going to happen.
Let's move on a bit. Kind of in the vein of this Me Too movement, the editor of the New York Review of Books is out of a job after publishing a piece by a guy named Gian Gomeshi. He's a former radio host who was fired after accusations that he sexually abused upwards of 20 women. Gomeshi was the host of a radio program called Q from the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Perhaps your station used to run that program before he was let go. Now, that piece in the New York Review of Books set off this wave of criticism against Gomeshi and against the review for publishing it. The editor, Ian Baruma, further fanned the flames when he appeared to downplay the concerns over Gomeshi during an interview with Slate magazine. Chris Potter, I wonder what your sense is of whether this should have cost Baruma his job, whether the essay should have been published in the first place. This feels like it's been a pretty hot debate in journalistic circles, particularly whether or not these men who have been caught up in the Me Too movement deserve to be heard, deserve to tell their side of the story.
Well, I don't think the question, I think that's a bit of a false choice, right? Because the question isn't, do these men deserve to be heard? They're being heard, right? I mean, it's a sort of, how can we miss you if you never go away kind of thing. And I think part of what people are objecting to is not so much that we heard these voices, but that we heard them to the exclusion of the voices. I mean, the other example of this is Harper's Magazine also ran a first-person essay by another public radio personality, the takeaways, John Hockenberry. Again, a first-person essay. There were some footnotes where women sort of took issue with his views. But, you know, just kind of think about that. We are in this moment right now where women are able to speak to a greater extent maybe than any time in my lifetime about these experiences, about being victimized. And the first thing that happens is the men sort of grab these microphones back and monopolize them all over again. And I think that's a big part of the issue here is nobody's saying you can't have a voice in this, but you don't get to go back and take the microphone back and just hold it for yourself. And I think that's a big part of this.
Sally wrote on our Facebook page, how come when 300 boys come forward about sexual abuse from priests over 30 years ago, Everyone believes them and understands why it took them so long to come forward. Why is there such a double standard when women are afraid to come forward for so many years? Well, indeed, more people are coming forward. And here on Monday in Pittsburgh, a class action lawsuit was filed against Pennsylvania's 8 Catholic dioceses. The suit aims to get them to release all their documents related to allegations of the abuse of children and the blacked out or redacted information from a recent grand jury report. That report revealed hundreds of allegations against Pennsylvania priests that go back decades. Now, the lead plaintiffs have children in Catholic schools. One of the plaintiffs, Ryan O'Connor, says he was abused by a priest as a child. Here's part of what he said this week.
This is not about money. This is about transparency. This is about openness and honesty moving forward so that all parents can feel safe in the knowledge that their children are not in danger from predators.
It's Ryan O'Connor, one of the lead plaintiffs in this lawsuit. Selena Zito, let me start with you. Give us a sense of what the conversation has been like here in Pittsburgh around this case. You're Roman Catholic, right?
I am a Roman Catholic. I'm at church almost every Sunday, either whether I'm at home or if I'm out of town, I try to, you know, not miss. Went to Catholic schools for nine years, first through ninth grade. The first mass after the report came out by Attorney General Josh Shapiro was sparsely attended in the same church that I go to with my parents the most often in the neighborhood I grew up, was sparsely attended. And the people that were there, it was difficult to find anyone who wasn't crying. It really hit people very hard. These churches, in particular in places like Pittsburgh or Philadelphia or Harrisburg or, you know, even smaller towns like Erie or McKeesport, Catholic churches and the Catholic schools were very much the center of these towns. This is where kids went to school. As Chris mentioned in the earlier segment, there's fish fries every Sunday. And, you know, my particular parish, it was called Nativity of Our Lord Parish, city school, baby boomers bursting at the seams, tons of kids. It was a great place to go to school. I found out that three priests attended school, or one of my siblings did, were named in the affidavit. And it really made me step back and think and wonder, you know, what kid on the side of the playground was sad? What kid changed? What kids, you know, wasn't the same anymore? And you replay people's faces and behaviors in your head, and you wonder who was hurting. I mean, these are children. I think it's impacting attendance. I don't think it's impacting faith. It hasn't impacted my faith. Trust in the institution, the church. With air quotes around it, absolutely. And that goes probably for a lot of things in this country that we have lost faith in institutions.
We've heard that a lot, including from Catholics who have commented to us in previous programs that it has shaken their faith in the human part of the church, but
right,
that their direct relationship,
yes,
with God either was unaffected or it was reaffirmed because,
yes,
they had to do the soul searching and kind of recommit themselves to their faith. With regards to the lawsuit, Chris, what are the prospects for it and what might come out of this if it succeeds?
If the suit were to succeed, there are a number of asks, as you said. I mean, some of those were just very simply to unredact names that were redacted in the original grand jury report. What they're asking for is much, much more sweeping. That is sort of decades, going back decades, every allegation you've had, and going forward, and an outright admission of the church's sins here. This is a very expansive lawsuit in terms of kind of calling this church to account. And I think we're in this. Everything we're talking about here today, media, the church, our political system,
yep,
we're talking about, this is an amazing historical moment. We're talking about the foundations of all of these institutions, and they are founded on the silence of people who have been victimized by them. And those people are rising up and speaking out, and we're just seeing it across. This is just an amazing moment now.
Yeah, absolutely.
The lead plaintiffs in this case, we should note, are both parents of children,
yes,
in Catholic schools. Here's one more cut from that lead plaintiff, Ryan O'Connor.
My children go to Catholic school. I will keep my children in Catholic school. I am a practicing Catholic. My wife and I go to church. We take our children to church. We believe in the church as an institution. I have not lost faith in my religion. I have lost faith in the men who are pulling the purse strings.
Thanks to WESA's Virginia Alvino Young for those audio cuts. You'll find more of this station's reporting on the scandal online at WESA.FM. Let's talk a bit about the aftermath of Hurricane Florence. At least 42 deaths have now been attributed to the impacts of this storm. The damage from it amounts to billions of dollars in the Carolinas and Virginia. As it made landfall, it was downgraded to a Category 1 hurricane from a Category 4, eventually became a tropical depression before it was just a big field of rain. It was initially captured on radar as a Cat 5. Considering how much devastation this caused anyway, Cheryl, I wonder how much this storm has changed the conversation about the way we deal with this, with disasters, especially because of some of the controversy surrounding FEMA in the days leading up to Florence making landfall.
Right. Well, a couple of things actually have changed about FEMA since Katrina. The federal government now requires experience for the job of the FEMA director. Unfortunately, though, the current FEMA director, Brock Long, is embroiled in a controversy right now. He's being investigated by the Department of Homeland Security for possible misuse of government vehicles. So that is kind of a distraction. And, you know, the president himself has also injected controversy into the way the government responds with his comments about Hurricane Maria. As you'll remember, he asserted that Democrats were making up the 3,000 deaths that occurred in Puerto Rico to discredit him, that they were wildly inflating the number. So I guess from where I sit, a lot of the discussion about FEMA has sort of been submerged in some of these other kind of distracting issues.
Speaking of the president, he traveled to New Bern, North Carolina this week and toured some of the damaged neighborhoods. Here is part of what he said to homeowners who had dealt with storm damage.
How do you deal with the houses? How do you do?
Every house on this street flooded, and we're on this road, too.
Will they be saved, though, for the most part?
I hope so. I really hope so.
So you've never seen one like this?
Never. Never.
You've been here for years, and you haven't seen
it? Over 30 years and never seen it.
We're going to be with you. You know that. We're with you already. So we'll get it fixed up. Okay?
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Part of President Trump's visit to New Bern, North Carolina, meeting victims of Hurricane Florence. Let's talk immigration. Cheryl, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced early this week that the Trump administration plans to reduce the number of refugees who can be resettled in the U.S. As I understand it, this is the lowest cap on refugees since the refugee program was created in 1980. Do we have any reason, any understanding of the Trump administration's rationale for lowering the cap?
Well, first of all, you're exactly right. It is the lowest ceiling that the president that any president has placed on the refugee program since 1980. I would note that in 2008, the last year of the Bush administration, the program accepted 80,000 refugees in 1 year. The current number that the president has imposed is 30,000, I believe. And I think what we're seeing here is an outgrowth of the president's policies on immigration. Look, this is a president who ran for office vowing to build a wall and attacking illegal immigrants, but he has also moved assiduously to reduce legal immigration to the United States. He speaks frequently about wanting to end what he calls chain migration. That's family-based migration, where if I'm an immigrant, I can bring my mom and my dad over, or my brother and my sister. He wants to reduce that. And the flow of refugees, these are legal immigrants who are coming into this country, escaping, you know, places of violence and where their lives are threatened and persecution, and they are gaining refugee status here. And he simply wants that to lessen. That's what we're seeing here.
WESA's Chris Potter, Selena Zito of The Washington Examiner and The New York Post, and Cheryl Gay Stolberg of The New York Times, thank you all very much for being with us.
We'll dive into the international section of the Friday News Roundup in just a moment.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste.
you need help getting your shortlist of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Hi, I'm Daniel Alarcón, host of NPR's Spanish language podcast, Radio Ambulante. This week, a year after the earthquakes that devastated the country, Mexico is still dealing with the aftermath. Schools were especially damaged, and the government promised to rebuild them fast, but two journalists discovered that the truth about that reconstruction is much more complicated.
Save the Children issues another dire warning for Yemen. 1 million more children are now at risk of famine. That means that more than 5 million kids could starve to death unless the civil war there ends. European Union leaders deal a blow to the British government's latest plan for an orderly Brexit next spring. And a pop star from Uganda, who's also an opposition politician, returns home to cheering crowds and hostile security forces. Joining us today for the Friday News Roundup back at our home base in D.C. is Mark Landler, White House correspondent for The New York Times. Mark, welcome back.
Thank you, Joshua.
Nancy Youssef, national security reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Nancy, welcome.
Great to be with you.
And Edward Luce, chief U.S. columnist and commentator at the Financial Times. His latest book is called The Retreat of Western Liberalism. Ed, glad to have you with us.
Great to be here, Joshua.
Let's start in Yemen with what has often been called the Forgotten War. The European Union has called it the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. And charities are now warning that more than 5 million children are at risk from famine. According to the UN, more than 17,000 civilians have been killed or injured in this civil war in Yemen since it began. Most of those injuries and deaths are attributed to airstrikes led by a Saudi-led coalition backed by the United States. That coalition is supporting the Yemeni government. The Houthi rebels they're fighting are backed by Iran. We've talked before about this being a proxy war. This week, that Saudi-led coalition relaunched its offensive to reclaim Hudaya, a rebel-held city. Nancy Youssef, explain what's at stake in Hudaya and why this battleground is so important.
So Hudaya is home to the port that is really the lifeline for Yemen. About 80% of goods and medicine and other aid comes through that port. And so who controls the port arguably controls Yemen. And it's one of the reasons you saw the report from Save the Children warning about the humanitarian crisis ahead, because as this offensive goes on, it would appear that it'll be harder and harder to get goods and services to a country where people are already suffering and starving and not able to get or receive access to basic goods and services.
So this is literally the lifeline in Yemen. Remind us, Nancy, what spurred this civil war in Yemen and then how it became a proxy war?
So the Saudis and the UAE saw a rising threat from the Iranian-backed Houthis after the overthrow of the government there. This was all sort of triggered by Arab Spring, and then moved in and conducted an offensive there. I think there was a feeling that this would be a quick-led offensive, and instead it's become a protracted conflict. And because you have Iran backing the Houthis and the Sunni-dominated UAE and Saudi Arabia conducting strikes on the other side for the government that they believe should be in power, it's seen as a proxy war between the major Sunni states versus a major Shia state.
Ed Luce, the non-governmental organization Save the Children warned that more Yemenis are facing famine. As we mentioned, it's up to 5.2 million children, just children, who are at risk. Can you paint us a bit of a clearer picture as well of just how devastating the civil war has been, not just for children, but for Yemen in general?
Yes, I mean, it's been it's not just now the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. It has been, along with Syria, the worst for several years now. One sort of measure of how bad it's the direct effect of the Saudi-Emirati war on the Houthis has been is that the UN came out with a report last month condemning the Saudi-UAE operation and said that I think 11,600 children have been killed in collateral airstrikes, something around that. I might not have got the number precisely correct, but as collateral damage from Saudi Emirati airstrikes. So that gives you, with a country of about 20 million people, that gives you a sense of just how large the scale of devastation is. There's been particular incidents. There was a Saudi Emirati airstrike on a bus that killed 20, 30 children last month that came out before, that occurred before the UN report. The international condemnation of Saudi Emirati methods and their lack of precision has been carrying on for the last 2 years, but it doesn't seem to be getting any better.
Yeah, with regards to that, the condemnation, Ed Sandby wrote on our website, the1a.org, sadly, the international community cares as much for the Yemeni people as it does for the Syrian people. Not one bit. Mark Landler, what about that? I feel like Sandby has a point that this is just not one of these wars that we hear that much about. On the other hand, because it's a proxy war, there are all these other factors involved. Like getting involved with Yemen necessarily means dealing with Saudi Arabia and dealing with Iran. And I wonder if that aspect of it complicates the ability of world powers to do anything.
Well, that's exactly right. And this is where the United States has a deep stake in this conflict. The United States is allied with the Saudis and the Emiratis. It supplies aerial refueling to the Saudis and the Emiratis so that they can carry out these strikes. It also shares intelligence with them. So it is a major background player in this conflict, even though it's not involved in any operations itself. And that's put the Trump administration in an increasingly compromised position, I would argue. The Congress, which is worried to some extent about humanitarian abuses in Yemen, has made it a condition of continued military aid to the Saudis and Emiratis that the administration certify that Saudi Arabia and the UAE are doing what they can to mitigate collateral damage and casualties. This became an issue just in the past few weeks within the State Department because even inside the administration and the State Department itself, there are a number of officials and experts who have been advising Secretary of State Mike Pompeo that that certification is not easy to make. There isn't enough evidence that the Saudis are trying to mitigate collateral damage. What Mike Pompeo did, and my colleagues at the Wall Street Journal had a very good story about this, he actually overrode the advice of some of his experts on this and went ahead and certified to, in part, preserve many, many billions of dollars worth of arms deals that the United States has with Saudi Arabia. So this is a difficult issue. The Trump administration and Jared Kushner, the president's son-in-law, have made close relations with Saudi Arabia a centerpiece of U.S. Middle East strategy, but they are now finding out the cost attached to having those alliances and the position it can put them in with respect to potentially a huge humanitarian crisis.
Let's make our way to Europe, where leaders in the EU have rejected a plan laid out by Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May. That plan would spell out how the UK would intend to leave the EU in a little over 6 months. Now, Prime Minister May kind of wants to have her cake and eat it too, eyeing an ongoing economic relationship with the EU after leaving the bloc in March 2019. She spoke to reporters after what was dubbed an informal summit in Austria, but Mrs. May did little to hide her disappointment.
I've just had a frank bilateral meeting with President Tusk. He's confirmed the commitment of the other 27 member states to reaching a deal as soon as possible. But there are two key issues we need to resolve. We both agree there can be no withdrawal agreement without a legally operative backstop. But that backstop cannot divide the United Kingdom into two customs territories, and we will be bringing forward our own proposals shortly. On the economic partnership, there is no solution that will resolve the Northern Ireland border which is not based on the frictionless movement of goods. Our white paper remains the only serious and credible proposition on the table for achieving that objective.
That's Britain's Prime Minister Theresa May and the Mr. Tusk that she referred to as Donald Tusk, who is the president of the European Council. Ed Luce, let me start with you. Clearly, there were a lot of objections. What exactly did the EU leaders object to?
Well, the sort of founding sort of principles of the EU is the free movement, the four freedoms, the free movement of people, goods, capital and services. And the plan that Theresa May took to Salzburg was her Chequers plan, named after the Prime Minister's country retreat, which she thrashed out with her own cabinet in July, two of whom resigned in protest, one of whom was Boris Johnson, over this Chequers plan. And that Chequers plan really asks for Britain to participate in only one of those freedoms, and that is freedom of movement of goods. And she had to propose that because she doesn't want a border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. And if you have a customs check, then you've got a border. So she came to Salzburg proposing this Chequers plan. Britain would just participate in the freedom of movement of goods, and Europeans, as expected, as they've always said, is we will not compromise the four freedoms. They are indivisible. If you are part of want free movement of goods, you have to accept free movement of capital, services, and crucially, people, which of course was what the Brexit referendum was rejecting. So unsurprisingly, I mean, some of the media reports say Theresa May, you know, was humiliated deliberately by the EU leaders. I think it's probably fairer to say that she went in with only the chance of only hearing one answer, which was no, we don't accept that. And that's always been our stance. And so she's now, you know, drawing a line in the sand and saying Britain will not be divided by Europe, but Europe's got to be more flexible, really stuck in a political corner. It's unclear how she's going to dig herself out of it. To put it mildly, the hills were not alive with the sound of music in Salzburg.
Nicely done. I did want to ask you about the Ireland, Northern Ireland thing briefly. I don't want to get too deep into the weeds of that. Ireland is an EU member. Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom. How does Theresa May propose dealing with that border issue?
Well, this is why she says that Britain wants to have freedom of movement of goods, so that there doesn't need to be customs checks on the British border with the Republic of Ireland, which is, of course, the Northern Irish border. The EU is saying, no, that the border actually has to be between, in the Irish Sea, between the island of Britain and the island of Ireland. And she says that's unacceptable, that divides Britain. It cuts off Northern Ireland from the British mainland. So the way this is going is that Britain is probably going to have to say, Theresa May is going to have to agree that Britain will join the customs union. And that means if Britain joins the customs union, that Britain has no say over European trade, but it is part of all trading arrangements Europe makes with the rest of the world. But more crucially, Britain cannot negotiate its own trade deals with anybody, including Donald Trump's administration and China and India, which is the whole sort of, some would say, rather romantic premise of the Brexit referendum in the first place, that Britain goes it alone globally as a free trading nation.
Mark Landler, give us a sense of what this means for Theresa May politically right now. It's about 2 weeks, not quite 2 weeks, before the UK's Conservative Party's annual conference. Theresa May is a conservative. I have heard comparisons of this situation to Monty Python's dead parrot sketch, where the parrot is actually dead and the insistence that it's just resting doesn't really fly. I mean, does this make Theresa May look like she's kind of going into her conference trying to revive a dead parrot?
Well, to some extent, Theresa May inherited a poison chalice when she became the head of the government under these circumstances. There's really almost no room to find a compromise that works for her. As Ed, you know, alluded to, Boris Johnson resigned over the Chequers plan and has been leading a fairly open insurgency against Theresa May ever since. It's likely, certainly possible, if not likely, that her leadership will be challenged at this Conservative Party meeting. And that's why this notion of humiliation is playing so big in the British press after the Salzburg meeting. And the EU hasn't helped her in that regard. There was an interesting episode that happened after the meeting where Donald Tusk, the EU president, posted a picture of himself and Theresa May on Instagram. The two of them are looking at a platter of desserts, and the caption under the photo is, a piece of cake, perhaps, sorry, no cherries. And the allusion he was making there was to the complaint the EU has that Britain wants to cherry pick its agreement with the EU, taking out things it likes and rejecting things it doesn't like. And he was making it clear, sorry, Theresa, you don't get that. That went over very badly in Britain. A lot of people thought it was a real insult to the prime minister. And that just underscores the position she finds herself going into this party convention. Whether she emerges as prime minister, I guess, is anybody's guess. But she's really almost in an impossible position.
Yeah, Nancy Youssef, I was going to try to ask you also about kind of what happens now. We've got, and I like the two metaphors we had working, Mark and me. We've got this dead parrot, presumably killed by the poison chalice, I guess. But if this end of March deadline to leave the EU comes, which is the deadline, and there's no deal worked out, Britain's just out of luck? Like, what does that mean if there's the deadline but no deal?
It seems that everyone's out of luck, because then you have essentially a very messy exit by the UK where these kinds of issues haven't been worked out. And now you're not in that negotiating position, but you're having to negotiate while things are in movement. And I think that's why there's such a desperate attempt to try to reach some sort of deal before then. And yet, as Mark was spelling out, the political limitations that Theresa May is under doesn't allow her perhaps to put forward the kinds of proposals that the EU would embrace, something more like the relationship that it has with Canada or Norway. And so I think what you're seeing is a very defiant Theresa May. And we saw that most recently this morning, U.S. time, when she gave a speech before Downing Street, essentially saying she wasn't going to budge from the Chequers position.
We'll continue our conversation in a moment. Stay close.
This message comes from NPR sponsor ADT. America's trusted home security company can help protect you against break-ins, fires, and carbon monoxide. 24/7 emergency response when you need it most. More at ADT.com.
Hi, this is Peter Sagal. For 20 years, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me has been making fun of the news with comedians and celebrity guests. We got silly limericks, we got terrible impressions. If you think the news is a joke, wait till you hear our show. New podcast episodes are available every Saturday.
Back now to the Friday News Roundup with Ed Luce, Mark Landler, and Nancy Youssef. Another story we're following out of Britain, besides Brexit, is a war for worldwide media dominance. It continues this weekend with the auction of a British broadcaster valued at $36 billion. Sky is a pay TV service that reaches across Europe. 21st Century Fox owns part of Sky, and it's trying to buy the rest. But Comcast wants to buy it all. Disney is also involved because it is acquiring Fox's entertainment assets, including Fox's stake in Sky. Now, auctioning off a media network is really rare, but British regulators say it would be an orderly way to resolve this. The auction begins when the London Stock Exchange closes today, and it should end tomorrow evening. A quick question on Brexit, Ed, and I wonder if you could respond to Paul, who tweeted, "As I watch our friends across the pond thrash around in these Brexit negotiations, I have to wonder, why not a second referendum? Every outcome now seems like a terrible deal for them, and Brexit itself is much less popular among Brits now." Ed?
In a perfect world, there would be a second referendum, and there might yet still be down the line. But unfortunately, if Theresa May called for one, which she has absolutely no inclination to do, her party would split apart. There would have to be a general election. She would lose her job. The Brexiteers would cry betrayal. And the pro-Brexit tabloid media, who, you know, have used terms such as enemies of the people, there's a sort of Alex Jones tinge to some of the Brexiteer campaigning in Britain. They would threaten to make Britain ungovernable, to which the answer is it already seems to be ungovernable. What have you got to lose? But the only other objection, a slightly more subtle one, is let's say we did have a second referendum. The scenario for which would be probably a hard Brexit, a no-deal Brexit, where Britain just flunks out and there's chaos and everybody then gets buyer's remorse. Let's say we do get a second referendum and this time the vote is to remain. If it were the same margin of victory as the original Brexit vote had, which is 52-48, would that settle anything?
Good question. And it's also, I think it's also worth noting, Ed, that the last prime minister, David Cameron, lost his job because the referendum didn't go his way. That's exactly why he lost his seat. So I'm sure Theresa May doesn't want to meet the same fate as David Cameron.
Exactly. The poison chalice was the term used earlier. This is a poison chalice that cannot be turned into some sort of nice, milky, you know, nutritional substance. It's very hard to get from that point to a good one.
Should I be offended, Ed, that you went for Mark's poison chalice instead of my dead parrot? I gave you a Monty Python layup.
I like the dead parrot. I was just struggling. I know I'm required because I'm British to remember the entire sort of script to that sketch, and I can't, so I was avoiding it.
We'll let you off the hook this time. How about we move on from Brexit so we don't have to deal with the dead parrot? And let's deal with the very live debate between the U.S. and North Korea over North Korea's nuclear future. This week, we learned that North Korea's leader Kim Jong-un wants to meet again with President Trump a few months after they met in Singapore. South Korea's President Moon Jae-in returned from a meeting with Chairman Kim in Pyongyang this week. He announced that Kim had expressed a desire to meet President Trump again. Mr. Trump tweeted this week about denuclearization efforts on the Korean Peninsula. He wrote in part, quote, "Kim Jong-un has agreed to allow nuclear inspections subject to final negotiations and to permanently dismantle a test site and launch pad in the presence of international experts. In the meantime, there will be no rocket or nuclear testing," unquote. That's from a tweet from President Trump. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke to Fox News host Laura Ingraham on Wednesday. She asked him about President Trump's relationship with Kim Jong-un. Here's part of what Secretary Pompeo said.
"We have made steady, albeit slow progress, but we've always known this was going to take some time. The South Koreans had a successful engagement, President Moon with Chairman Kim, just over the last 48 hours, where we made another step where we will get verification of an element of North Korea's program on the ground. That's a good thing. We're moving forward. The relationship between Chairman Kim and President Trump is good."
That was Secretary of State Mike Pompeo speaking on Fox News. Nancy Youssef, react to that clip for us in terms of the relationship between Chairman Kim and President Trump.
Well, one could argue that the talks that we saw this week was an opportunity for Kim Jong-un to resuscitate the talks that appeared all but dead, or at least dying in the last few weeks, that while Mr. Trump and Chairman Kim celebrated their relationship, the talks themselves hadn't really moved. As you recall, the president had told Mike Pompeo at the last minute just last month not to travel to North Korea for the latest talks. I think what we saw this week more than anything is a North Korea that is committed to improving inter-Korea relations, but I'm not sure that it's clear that they're committed to denuclearize. You mentioned some of the agreements that they made at the beginning, including getting rid of its launch pad, but one could argue that they're using mobile launchers and don't need that launch pad. And while they talk about decommissioning a nuclear enrichment facility, there are other ones there. And so I think what we saw was a relationship that, in a way, that's kind of moving beyond the Trump-Kim one to improving relationships between President Moon and Chairman Kim and coming up with ways to improve that.
Mark Landler, should we expect another summit after these comments? I mean, is that likely, viable?
I think it's possible that Trump and Kim will meet again. But what's sort of interesting about this is that you now have a tension between the administration, President Trump's top advisors, who are in the main deeply skeptical about Kim and his intentions to denuclearize, and the president himself, who keeps hailing evidence of progress and goodwill on the part of the North Koreans. So you sort of have this prospect of Trump perhaps wanting to have a meeting, and Kim certainly wanting to have one, but the Mike Pompeos and the John Boltons of this world being far more skeptical and perhaps resistant. And I guess if I were to, in my struggle to find a way to use your dead parrot metaphor, I think that Mike Pompeo is the dead parrot in this equation, because he is tasked with obtaining a denuclearization deal with North Korea when there's no evidence the North Koreans are going to give him one. And he works for a guy who is not going to look kindly on his failure to produce that deal. And if he does fail to produce it, he will no doubt be blamed and thrown under the bus by the president.
Could I just add, I think the other source of tension arguably is between South Korea and the United States, and I think we started to see evidence of that this week with President Moon saying that really, United States, you should sign a peace deal ending essentially the armistice that exists now. And that's something that, from the U.S. perspective, is just not open at this point for negotiation, that doing so would sort of validate arguably a nuclear-armed North Korea, and that the North Koreans would immediately call for the withdrawal of the 28,500 U.S. troops in South Korea. So I think we're starting to see a friction arguably developing as these talks move one way, and the U.S. at this point not able to sort of secure those commitments that it needs to go forward.
Let's shift from the Korean Peninsula to China, where this week President Trump escalated his trade war again. He put more tariffs on $200 billion worth of Chinese goods. China then retaliated with $60 billion worth of penalties. Both sides say they're still open to talks. Ed Luce, where are we in this trade war? I'm not even sure whether this is an escalation, whether this is just a procedural step. Where do you see us?
It's a well-signaled escalation, and the next steps of escalation are also well-signaled. We are almost halfway towards Donald Trump, the U.S. administration, imposing punitive tariffs on 100% of Chinese imports into the United States. And China, you know, is also, although American imports into China are far lower, hence the source of the problem, there's a big deficit, China is also in retaliation step by step, also almost halfway towards imposing full tariffs on all American imports. So this isn't the prospect of a trade war. We are in a trade war. The problem here is that the Chinese keep sort of reaching out to say, can we negotiate this? And indeed, next week, Xi Jinping, the president of China's economic advisor, Liu He, and I've probably not pronounced that exactly correctly, is going to be visiting Washington and has offered to negotiate with the Trump administration. But it's unclear who he would negotiate with, who the Chinese think is speaking on the president's behalf, and what the president actually wants to do. There are different voices in the administration. There's Secretary of Treasury Steve Mnuchin, who is more emollient. There is Peter Navarro, the Death by China author, who is very much, you know, for China trade war. There is Robert Lighthizer, the U.S. trade representative, who is probably best at channeling Trump's views, but even he doesn't have a grand plan that he's proposing to the Chinese. You accept this and you know, we'll call off the trade war. It's unclear what it is the Chinese would be negotiating for.
One story that caught our attention this week: a Dutch resistance fighter who was instrumental in fighting the Germans in World War II died this month at the age of 92. Freddie Overstegen joined the resistance at the age of 14. Her job? Luring Nazi soldiers and Dutch traders out of taverns and into the woods, where she shot them. And that's not all. Overstegen and her sister blew up rail lines with dynamite, shot Nazis while riding bikes, and wore disguises to smuggle Jewish children out of concentration camps. In an interview, Overstegen once said, quote, "We had to do it. It was a necessary evil, killing those who betrayed the good people," unquote. And when she was asked how many people she had killed or helped kill, she said, quote, "One should not ask a soldier any of that." I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. On Sunday, a runner from Kenya broke a world record. Eliud Kipchoge broke the world record by running the Berlin Marathon in 2 hours, 1 minute, 39 seconds. If the time is certified, he will steal the title from another Kenyan, Dennis Kimeto. Kipchoge's been working toward beating that 2-hour mark for more than a year, and now it seems within reach. Also in Africa, a Ugandan pop star turned politician and opposition leader arrived back home yesterday after getting medical treatment in the U.S. for injuries he said he sustained from torture while in Ugandan police custody. Robert Chagulani, better known as Bobby Wine, was first arrested in August and charged with treason. While he was in the U.S. for medical treatment, he spoke with NPR's Scott Simon on Weekend Edition. He told Scott that he was planning to return, even though it was dangerous. But before he was arrested, someone shot into his car and killed his driver. Wine says the bullet was meant for him.
It sounds like you expect Yes.
Something violent.
Yes, I'm supposed to be a dead man. It was just a few seconds when I left that seat where I was sitting that my driver was shot. We are living in a country where life does not mean a thing. I'm not sure whether this is not the last time I'm coming here or to any other country. So I've decided to dedicate every last bit of my life to raise that voice. There are more than 40 million Ugandans. 85% of them are younger than me. I am 36 years old, and we have a demographic of over 85% under the age of 35. So it cannot be about my life. I've said this before, and I'll say it again. We have to win back our freedom and dignity, or we shall die trying.
That's Bobby Wine of Uganda speaking to NPR's Scott Simon on Weekend Edition Saturday. Wine was seized by security forces yesterday after his plane touched down. Police said in a statement that he was simply escorted home. Nancy, can you give us a sense of what's going on here between Bobby Wine and Uganda's president, Yoweri Museveni, and kind of where this stands now?
I think very simply, we're seeing the biggest challenge to the presidency since he was elected in 1986. And you're seeing a society that is essentially, at least for supporters of Wine, who are fed up with the corruption, the unemployment, and the quality of life that they have there. And so in one of the youngest countries in the world and arguably one of the most ethnically diverse, you're starting to see a real challenge. And where it takes us is arguably either towards more friction, or if Bobby Wine prevails and his vision prevails, he says, the democratic transfer, peaceful transfer of power.
One more story that caught our interest this week before we have to go. If you had a chance to fly into space on a rocket from Elon Musk, would you take it? Well, the CEO of Tesla made news this week. On Monday, he announced at a press conference that a Japanese billionaire named Yusaku Maezawa will be the first commercial passenger on the SpaceX rocket called the Big Falcon. Mark Landler, before we go, could you tell us a little bit about Yusaku Maezawa, why he's riding on this rocket, and whether you would consider riding shotgun?
Well, it takes a lot to upstage Elon Musk. Just in the past few weeks, he's been in the news for a lot of things, including smoking marijuana on a radio show and giving a very revealing interview to the New York Times about his mental state. But at this news conference, he was thoroughly upstaged by Maezawa, this Japanese billionaire, who is by all accounts going to spend millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars to be on this SpaceX rocket when it flies to the moon. And what's interesting is he's going to, he says, take a very unconventional crew, artists and performers. And the way he phrased it is, I choose to go to the moon with artists. So to your question of what would I go, I might be interested. I'm not certain I'd make the cut. I don't think Maezawa might consider what I do artistry.
But none of us are actually smoking marijuana in the studio. I just want to point that one out.
Oh, thank you, Ed.
So I leave town for one day and the party dies. Is that what you're saying? Mark Landler, White House correspondent for the New York Times. Mark, thanks for talking to us.
Sure thing.
Nancy Youssef, national security reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Thanks, Nancy.
My pleasure.
And Ed Luce, chief U.S. columnist and commentator for the Financial Times. Thanks, Ed.
Many thanks.
Thanks to WESA Public Radio in Pittsburgh for hosting us this week. You'll find more of their excellent reporting online at wesa.fm. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you so much for listening. Enjoy your weekend, and we'll be back home in Washington on Monday. This is 1A.